think Katerina was talking about the need in academic argumentation discussion to have a fair exchange of epistemic goods. I feel like I'm going to shortchange you in a sense, because I've learned so much from the philosophers and psychologists here, and I don't feel I'm going to give enough back from the perspective of a linguist. But because of that anxiety about not giving you enough back and not having this fair exchange, I ended up sort of losing the plot a bit on this, which, and I probably should just focus on the issue of bullshit. But I thought talking about bullshit to a group of philosophers is a bit like taking Colts to Newcastle. So then I thought last night, no, I'm going to have to redo everything and try and focus on the discourse and analysis side of thing, which most of you perhaps don't know as much about as the philosophy and psychology and so on. But anyway, I hope it doesn't end up as a load of bullshit. But also, I thought, another anxiety, I thought, well, okay, it's dogmatism and bullshit, but this, yesterday, anyway, everyone was focused very narrowly, and which was very nice, on the issue of the title of the conference, which of arrogance and polarization. So I've got to make this more in sync with that. No one has mentioned dogmatism, so I thought we'd better call it arrogance and bullshit. And I think that there are... I think there are clear connections between bullshit and arrogance, and I'm gonna call on you guys to help me see those connections. So I thought this was quite a nice quote. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant he could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21. I was astonished at how much he had learned in 7 years. And I thought this is a nice sort of states in a nutshell, this rite of passage from a sort of young intellectual arrogance to a form of intellectual humility, recognising that, you know, that others can perhaps know more than you think and perhaps more than you do. But I also like this quote, because this is attributed on the internet everywhere to Mark Twain. There's one slight problem with that attribution. Does anyone know what it is? Mark Twain's father died when he was 11. And there's no, as far as I can see, there's no evidence that this is from any of his fiction. So, you know, once again, fake news, or at least fake attribution. I don't trust any quote I find on the internet now. I've found so many fake quotes, it's unbelievable. This is another one that I came across because I've just finished writing a book on lying and bullshit. I was interested in the origin of the phrase "lie, lie, pants on fire," and so I googled that and got the best answer of Yahoo, which is that "lie, lie, pants on fire, hanging on the telephone wire" is a paraphrased version of the 1810 poem "The Liar" by William Blake. And then there's the entire poem, which goes on a bit. Now, I'm not a Blake expert, but reading that poem didn't convince me at all that this was Blake. So I checked it out, and of course it's not. It's a fake poem. But what's interesting about this is that this is, you know, crowned as the best answer. It has 696 likes. Deep down in the comments, or deep down in the possible answers, you have this one, which is classified from a Yahoo perspective as not so good an answer. There's no such poem by William Blake. I checked the Blake archive, and this, you have a specific reference that overrides this. I think we can safely judge this to be akin to an urban myth. Well, that one gets 5 likes and 1 dislike. And I think, again, that sort of sums up this what I prefer to call a post-factual world that we live in. And it is that type of thing that inspired me to do the work on lying and bullshit that I've been doing. Okay, so what I'm going to try to do is to firstly trying to give a sense of how a discourse analytic perspective might be different from a philosophical or psychological perspective to issues of virtues, epistemic virtues and vices. Then I want to look at the issue of epistemic irresponsibility. And finally, if there's time, at bullshit and its connection with arrogance. So, so I start out with some basic linguistic perspectives on ethical terms. I should point out that my linguistic colleagues on the whole avoid anything to do with ethics like the plague. We're taught in Ling 101 that we describe language, we don't evaluate language, and you know, the linguists would go to extraordinary lengths to avoid saying anything ethical or evaluative about language. So what can we do from a linguistic perspective in terms of ethical terms? Well, firstly, you can consider how the word is used in discursive practice. So for example, lie is very often used in actual practice to mean simply a factual false statement, or even that's something I don't like. I disagree with you entirely, and it's a purely affective reaction. So I think someone said yesterday that I think it was Robin who said that you're being arrogant is used in the same sort of way. It doesn't tell you actually anything about even people's understanding of the concept of lying or arrogance. So to get more at the what actually people understand by the concept, you can look at the way the word is used in reflective practice. This is done in semantics by giving people what we call lying scenarios, for example, in regard to the word lie, and then you get informants to judge those scenarios as lying or not lying. And the interesting thing about that is that when you get people to actually make judgments about scenarios as lying or not lying, they come out with judgments which are very similar to those of philosophers. So the key thing about lying, the absolutely central property of lying, is that the speaker needs to have a false belief. Almost that's just about the only thing that philosophical researchers of lying agree on, is that the speaker must have a false belief. And actually, when people are put in a position where they have to judge scenarios, they will tend to conform to that. But that doesn't say anything about the way that they will actually use the word lie. Thirdly, and this is what I've been trying to do, but which many of my linguistic colleagues would frown on, is to consider how we can categorize and ethically evaluate putatively untruthful or arrogant communicative behavior. Now, I think the other key input that this discourse analysis can give this area is the recognition that intellectually or morally vicious verbal behavior occurs in complex communicative contexts. Most philosophical work, you know, takes individual assertions, and most of the analysis is based on those, and the categorization is based on individual words or assertions. When you look at it from in terms of discourse analysis, you're looking at larger stretches of communication, and things start becoming a bit more complicated. In particular, and I think helpfully, we talk about people using discourse strategies to accomplish their communicative goals. When you look at untruthfulness in terms of these insincere discourse strategies, you can see that lying is often a discursive strategy of last resort in an overall strategy of concealing information. So, I'll give you an example from my actual specific area is language and law, the interface between linguistics and law. So this is an example which has been discussed enormously in the literature on language and law. This is the case is one of Samuel Bronson, a film producer, who had filed for bankruptcy. And during the hearing, the following exchange occurred between Bronson and a lawyer for one of his creditors. "Do you have any bank accounts in Swiss banks, Mr. Bronson?" "No, sir." "Have you ever?" "The company had an account there for about 6 months in Zurich." It transpired that Bronson had previously held a personal account in Zurich, which was now closed, and he was prosecuted for perjury. Now, the issue that is discussed in the literature is about whether he was committing perjury and thus effectively lying when he asked if the company had an account there for about 6 months in Zurich. But what I think is interesting is to actually trace through the development of this exchange. And you can see a hierarchy of insincere discourse strategies that build up here. So he starts off, "Do you have any bank accounts with banks, Mr. Bronson?" "No, sir." At this point, he's already withholding information. Specifically, he's omitting the information that would be expected in testimonial interrogation, that he would be indicated, "No, I didn't, but the company did." So he's deliberately concealing what the hearer has a right to know. Then he's followed up with, "Have you ever?" And he appears to volunteer the information at this point that the company had an account there for about 6 months in Zurich. Now, I would argue, along with many others, but not everyone, that what's going on here is that he's deliberately misleading through false implication. There is this falsely implies that through the greatest maximum of quantity, that if the company hadn't counted for about 6 months to do it, then he didn't. Now, the problem in terms of the legal case, and when the case got to the Supreme Court, this is what the Supreme Court said against the lower courts tribunals, is that in the context, in the highly adversarial context of cross-examination, what the cross-examiner should have done then is ask this question here: "Yes, but have you ever had a bank account in a Swiss bank?" And that would be the normal way that the cross-examiner would follow up. So effectively, the Supreme Court said, well, it's the cross-examiner's fault, Gov, because he should have followed up with that question. And of course, if he had followed up with that question, then the only way that that Bronson could have replied and while continuing to conceal the truth is, "No, I haven't," which would then be a case of straight lying. So you can see how, on the whole, you look at discourse, speakers will prefer one of these lower level forms of strategies of concealment, withholding, and or misleading, and have various categories of withholding and misleading, rather than the more committed lying. Okay, so one of the points I'm trying to make is that you need to see these as a set of possible strategies rather than simply an opposition between lying or not lying, which is often found in the philosophical literature. Okay, second point I want to make is with regard to epistemic irresponsibility. Now, so after Bernard Williams' work, Truth and Truthfulness, where Williams makes a distinction between virtues of sincerity and accuracy, Alessandra convinced me, I was sort of teaching her, but she convinced me that accuracy is inaccurate as a term for a virtue. And it is better to talk about epistemic responsibility. But basically, I'm embracing that Williams' distinction between two faces of truthfulness, sincerity, and epistemic responsibility. Now, this is already, this distinction, I think, is already inherent in Grice's maxim of quality. Sorry, I'm assuming here that that everyone knows Grice. I think Grice implicitly, but not explicitly, recognises these two faces of truthfulness in his maxim of quality, but they're restricted and negatively construed. So his maxim of quality has a super maxim: try to make your contribution one that is true. I would argue that this, and not the specific maxim one, is the maxim of truthfulness. And then you have the specific maxims: do not say what you believe to be false, which I'd call a maxim of sincerity, and then do not say that for which you lack adequate evidence, which I'd call a maxim of epistemic responsibility, except that I think that, sincerity is about more than just negatively not saying what you believe to be false, and epistemic responsibility is about more than simply adequate evidence. Now, so you've got these two faces of untruthfulness: insincerity, which I can give, I've used a couple of precedents to demonstrate this. So insincerity, classic Bill Clinton statement: I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Now, in this case, he knows, and we now know, that he did have some form of sex with her. So there's really only two options here in terms of untruthfulness. Either he's lying, because he believes he did have sexual relations, or he's misleading because he's relying on a stipulative legal definition of sexual relations that was devised by his legal team and that excluded fellatio, which I understand is what actually happened. But in either case, I think we can say that he's clearly being insincere and he's being willfully insincere. Another example of either lying or willful misleading, the Brexit bus, sometimes called. We send the EU £350 million a week, let's fund our NHS instead, vote leave. We actually send about £120 million a week. It's hard to believe that the people who came up with that were that unaware of how incorrect this was. Now, epistemic irresponsibility, on the other hand, is quite a different thing. Let's take this, one of many lovely examples of a Trump tweet. Give me clean, beautiful and healthy air, not the same old climate change, global warming bullshit. You can count it, whenever Trump uses the word bullshit, it's in the process of producing bullshit. I'm tired of hearing this nonsense. The point about this is there's nothing in there to suggest that that he's being insincere. What's wrong with it is it's simply not based on adequate evidence, and he's been irresponsible in the way that he's dealt with the evidence. So we can talk about a standard epistemic responsibility that we all have when we are talking. So epistemic responsibility is an intellectual virtue in which the speaking agent takes active responsibility for knowing. Epistemically responsible agents are those who, in Coe's words, in their knowings, strive to do justice to the object of the world they want to know as well as possible, and who value knowing and understanding how things really are. So the virtue lies in striving to do justice to the world and attempting to fulfill an obligation to fellow inquirers rather than in actually arriving at an elusive truth. Now, at that point, this is clearly an intellectual virtue. I argue that it can take the form of what I call epistemic negligence and therefore also become a morally blameworthy speech act. And I argue that this occurs when three conditions hold. Firstly, that the speaker had what I call a duty of epistemic care. This is similar to what Hart calls a role responsibility. So people in certain roles like doctors, lawyers, journalists, and even politicians have this epistemic duty of care. But this duty of epistemic care can also be discussed and negotiated. If you say to someone, trust me on this, you are taking on this duty of epistemic care. Secondly, the speaker fails to investigate sufficiently in accordance with her role and the duty of epistemic care. So obviously someone down the pub, having a conversation down the pub, doesn't have the same need to investigate sufficiently as someone in a position of institutional power, which might go to the point that someone made yesterday about people not necessarily looking up facts on their iPhone when they come up in conversation. Thirdly, the speaker failed to hedge her commitment to her assertions in accordance with the available evidence. And it is particularly this third condition where a discourse analysis can come in useful. So I'll give an example. How am I doing for time? Five. Okay. Okay, I'll cover this very quickly and go on to bullshit. Yeah, the example of negligence is over the Blair and weapons of mass destruction. So Blair lied, thousands died, and so on. The Iraq Inquiry was set up in 2009 to investigate Britain's involvement in Iraq before, during, and after the Iraq War in 2003. It sat for 7 years, and its report was finally released in July 2016. The Chilcot report was damning of then Prime Minister Tony Blair's actions leading up to the war, but it fell short of calling him a liar. A crucial piece of evidence in the 3.5 million word report is what Blair wrote in his foreword to the Iraq dossier that he presented to Parliament in September 2002 when he was trying to convince the resistant House to vote for war. What he said was this: what I believe the assessed intelligence has established beyond doubt is that Saddam has continued to produce chemical and biological weapons, that he continues in his efforts to develop nuclear weapons, and that he has been able to extend the range of his ballistic missile program. And he goes on, I am in no doubt that the threat is serious and current, that he has made progress on WMD, and that he has to be stopped. So what I'd point out here is firstly this subjective framing, I believe I am in, combined with these expressions of certainty, established beyond doubt and no doubt. Interestingly, this... So the question of did Blair lie? Well, he did willfully omit vital information about the Joint Intelligence Committee's reservations in the Iraq dossier. He also arguably willfully mislead through equivocation by framing his judgment in terms of personal conviction, I believe I am, which in asymmetrical power relationships would indicate this is just my opinion, but when you're in a position of supreme authority, it can also be read as I'm powerful and authoritative, so you can take what I believe as true. The question is, how can we establish that he was actually lying? And the answer to that, quite simply, is that we can't. In fact, Chilcot, in an interview, said that he thought Blair was emotionally truthful. Effectively saying, yes, he probably believed it, even if he was quite clearly wrong. So we can't actually get into people's heads to know. And Chilcot sums up, I think, quite acceptably, that the inquiry is not questioning Mr. Blair's belief, but the deliberate selection of a formulation which grounded the statement in what Mr. Blair believed rather than in the judgments which the JIC had actually reached in the assessment of intelligence indicates a distinction between his beliefs and the JIC's actual judgment. So what I think Chilcot's doing there, effectively saying that Blair was being epistemically negligent. And we can, again, we can see that he passes those conditions of indicators. PM, he had clearly had a duty of epistemic care. He was acting as a PM in Parliament, not turning down the pub. He failed to investigate sufficiently in accordance with his role, and he failed to hedge his commitment to his assertions in accordance with available evidence. Okay, finally get on to bullshit and arrogance. So how does bullshit come into the picture here? Well, of course, everyone knows Frankfurt's work on Frankfurt defines bullshit as a lack of connection to a concern with truth, and says that the fact about himself that the bullshitter hides is that the truth values of his statements are of no central interest to him. What we are not to understand is that his intention is neither to report the truth nor to conceal it. He argues that the speaker is focusing on audience effect rather than their epistemic value, what he's saying. He sees in direct opposition to lying, because liars on their own value the truth. But, crucially, Frankfurt still sees this as a matter effectively of insincerity, although he wouldn't use that word, as a counterpart to lying, rather than as a form of epistemic irresponsibility. I think this is wrong, because I question whether bullshit is always deceptive. So take another of Trump's tweets. Of course there was large-scale voter fraud happening on or before election day. Why do Republican leaders deny what is going on? So naive. Now, is this, as PolitiFact puts it, pants on fire? Or is it a case of what I call a credulous Trump? And in thinking about that, it's useful to bear in mind that over 60% of United Kingdom Independence Party supporters just before the EU referendum believed that the referendum would be rigged. And I couldn't find the figures, but I know it's something of the same thing was occurred with Trump supporters before the elections in the States. So I think it is actually plausible that he genuinely believed that it was large-scale voter fraud happening on before election day. What is deeply problematic, though, with tweets like this is the fact that, most fact checkers and most people are convinced that, yeah, it's quite clearly lying, which in fact voted him lie of the year and so on. But notice the score, PolitiFact scorecard. It's true, mostly true, half true, mostly false, false, pants on fire. You know, it's all to do with accuracy until you get to the pants on fire thing. When then the definition of that is a statement is not accurate and makes a ridiculous claim. So what if if we posit this credulous Trump, how can we analyse a tweet like that? Is it a mere innocent mistake? I think we'd be reluctant to say that. But if it is, what makes it bullshit if it's bullshit? And I'd argue that it's the complete lack of evidential grounding for his statement. But, and this is interesting, but possibly combined with an arrogant attitude. So you get things like normalization through, of course, exaggeration, large scale, presupposition, deny what is going on, why the problem is deny what's going on, and the belittling in so naive. So it could be this combination of evidential grounding and the arrogant attitude. Now, epistemic warrants can be suspended, but surely not after the event. So Trump famously said that the concept of the global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make US manufacturing non-competitive. He later said he was just joking. But, you know, at what point can you use that excuse? Of course, you can also have jokes on Trump. Trump famously said, if I were to run, I'd run as a Republican. They're the dumbest group of voters in the country. They believe anything on Fox News. I could lie, and they'd still eat it up. I bet my numbers would be terrific. Right, that shows that he actually is a liar, right? Except that it's fake news. So it's all a bit complicated. So conclusion. We need to look at epistemic virtues and vices in discursive context. I would argue that epistemic negligence can be as damaging as willful insincerity. Can one believe one's bullshit? I would argue that one can. And I wonder whether arrogance might actually underpin epistemically negligent bullshit.